I was in March of 69 to September of 73.
Mm-hmm. Now, what advice would you give these young veterans coming out of these war zones trying to adjust back to society?
Well, the first thing they got to realize that when they come out of these war zones, that they have been in a place that they would never thought they was going to be in the first place, and they have been changed from the person they was when they went in there or when they come out. Mm-hmm. Many of them are mental ill, and many of them just have to keep doing what Fred was saying, you know, make sure you file for your benefits and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And also, veterans got to stop depending on the governments all the time, because veterans got to help veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Veterans that are getting benefits should be helping veterans that do not have their benefits, veterans that are homeless, veterans that are laying out on the street that I see mostly every day where I'm at. So I realized that when a young brother come out, it's easy to get frustrated, and the one thing they should never get frustrated, and they ended up in jailhouses or penitentiaries, mm-hmm. or on drugs or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's my brother Rashad, who's an Air Force veteran, talking about helping homeless veterans and veterans helping each other. And this week on the Qumran Report, we're going to talk about homeless veterans and the homeless. And also in the latter part of our show, we will have a short reading from Wallace Terry's book, Bloods, by Matt Jennings, and it's about the African-American experience in the Vietnam War. Now, welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. And I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Our call-in number is 1-800-893-9562. This week on the Qumran Report, I'm delighted to have with us in the studio and on the phone, we will have Judy Bowman, and from the Rovi Theater Company, and she's going to talk to us a little about the Wallace Terry book, Blood, how it come about. And then Matt Jennings in the second part of the show will be reading a section from the book. And also to talk about homeless veterans and the homeless, Ted Hayes, founder of Dome Village, an innovative approach to solving the homeless problem, and Robert Bob Rosebrock, was going to talk to us about the history of the property that housed the West L.A. Veterans Administration. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Glad to be back again.
Yeah, let's go around the table and introduce ourselves and tell a little about the organizations that you represent.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ted Hayes, mm-hmm. Justiceville, activist, civil rights activist, homeless, and human rights. That's who I am.
Okay.
Bob Rosebrock. I'm director of the old Veterans Guard. We call it also the Veterans Revolution. And our mission is about protecting and defending the Los Angeles National Veterans Home in West L.A. that was deeded for veterans, and it's being used for everything but that. And we want to take that land back and make it a home again.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Matt. Tell us a little about what you're doing.
I'm Matt Jennings. I'm an actor. I've been affiliated with the Roby Theater Company for maybe about a year and a half now, and I'm just glad to be a part of this. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Good for you.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into our discussion about homeless veterans and the homeless, I would like to play a short 4-minute clip from a presentation I made at USC about solving the homeless problem. It was September the 12th, September 2012.
I'd like to say, now I am a veteran. I'm a Vietnam veteran, 1969 to 71. Can I tell you my age? Now, and not only am I a veteran, but I come from a family of veterans. Out of a family of 7 males and 2 females, 6 of us served in the military. three in the Army, two in the Air Force, and I served in the United States Marine Corps. So this is why this is such an important issue to me. And not only that, since we've been working in the Skid Row area, one of the things that we notice is how many veterans that's living in the streets. See, and we're going to talk about that in a little while when we do our monologue. And so what we try to do with Drama Stage Goomrun, we feel that people talk so much about the problems, that everybody knows the problems because it's amplified. You can read it in the paper and all that kind of stuff. What we try to talk about is solutions. Solutions. What is the solutions to the homeless problem? Now here's what we come up with. Because we talk to other homeless people who have been homeless, homeless veterans, and we want to get their opinions on what do they think it takes to solve the homeless problem. And here's where we at. I think the first step in solving the homeless problem is make the homeless problem the homeless veteran problem. That's the starting point. By making it the homeless veterans problem, you put it on the shoulders of the United States government who sent all of these young men over to fight in all of these particular wars and things like that and come back traumatized, et cetera, like that. So we feel that it is also the duty of the American government to finance the solutions to it. Not just the non-veterans who's laying in the street. We feel that the starting point make the homeless problem, the homeless veterans problem, get the American government to finance some think tanks where you can get some of the best minds in the United States, get them together, make the government pay for it, come up with some solutions, and then spread that solutions out to the rest of the homeless in terms of solving that. Now, what can the interfaith community do right now to make a dent in the homeless problem? Number one, I'm going to talk about Los Angeles because Los Angeles is the homeless capital. See, it's the homeless capital of the United States. Not only is this the homeless capital, you probably got more millionaires here in Los Angeles, kind of Los Angeles, probably than anywhere else in the United States. But you also got the blight of people laying down there in the Skid Row area down there. So here's the second part of doing something right now. We feel that the three major religions, the religious institutions, can also work with the city to find out all of these empty properties around here, to either buy these empty properties, rent these empty properties, and start programming what the Prophet Muhammad, what Moses, and what Jesus taught. It's right there in the scripture. You know, they started off, the Messiah Jesus, when he announced his messiahship. It's tied into that in Isaiah on what they were supposed to be doing. You know, working with people coming up out of prison, people in need and all that kind of stuff. And Brother Umar, he mentioned, it's tied into the scripture of Islam, it's also tied into the scripture of the Torah. See, so we feel that if these three major religions rent some of this empty property, start programming, start picking some of the people up that's on Skid Row, start bringing them into some of these houses, and at the same time provide support systems for them.
Okay, so what I'm going to talk about, what do you see as the main obstacle in the way of solving the homeless problem? Let's start over here with...
Well, for one thing, you got to get the money at the game. Mm-hmm. Homelessness, like the cancer research, has become an industry. Like the prison industrial complex, it's an industry. There's money, too much money in the game, too much money coming from the federal government in the game. I think that's been one of the big tricks. We'll talk about that. But most important, across the board, from the richest of the richest to the homeless, to the poorest of the poorest, there needs to be a change in everyone's heart. Not a big change, just a little mustard seed change of hope and a vision that this can be resolved without hurting or offending or taking from someone else. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that this is part of the savagery that goes on, is that everybody, most people in all industries, all works, are like in a survival mode. If I don't get and eat up as much as I can right now, somebody else going to do it. So I see an opportunity in homelessness to pay my bills, to get me a nice car and a house and a home, and to get some political prestige if I take on this cause. And I think a lot of people who are activists, I think, start off from the heart. They really want to help, but I think once they delve into the complexities of homelessness, they realize it's going to take some time. And what they thought would be volunteer time turns out to be full employment time. So therefore, they better get themselves paid and paid well. And if you look at some of the salaries of these advocates and activists, you can see what we're talking about. That's why it's so hard to unite people to work on a project, because everybody's, well, these folks are competing to be the number one top dog.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that change of heart is going to have to come from heaven. It's got to come from God. And I don't know yet quite how to do that other than what I am doing. I think ultimately it's going to fall down on God having to just touch people's hearts.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived with the homeless on the sidewalks here in downtown L.A. on purpose to see if I could understand what was going on. And I found out, as much as we want to nobilize homeless people, we are some of the most selfish people you ever want to come across.
Mm-hmm.
I see brothers and sisters fighting in line for a peanut butter sandwich. Mm. I see brothers and sisters fighting over a piece of sidewalk space. A few years ago, a young man and good friends went out and got drunk. They got drunk together. One guy came back early and fell asleep on the other brother's mattress on the sidewalk. The other brother came back drunk, saw him on his mattress. He ain't brought my mattress, grabbed a piece of iron pipe and killed the brother on the sidewalk over there. I think that the poorest of the poor and the richest of the rich have more in common than what people realize, because both of them wake up in the morning thinking, me, me, my, I, me, my, my.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the middle class wake up every morning thinking, my gosh, I got to go to work, take care of my family, take care of people. But the richest of the richest and the poorest of the poor have that luxury of waking up saying, me, me, my. So everybody's heart's got to change, not just the rich people and the powerful people, but the homeless as well.
Okay. What are your thoughts on that, Bob?
Good. Well, thanks. I really appreciate this opportunity. And I think we're the capital for homeless veterans here in Los Angeles. And I think one of the first things we have to come and reckon with that this is a state of emergency. Until you declare that, it's just homeless veterans. And I've reached out. I'm in the 33rd Congressional District, which is Henry Waxman's. He's been overseer for 40 years. He's retiring. I've written him letters asking him to declare a state of emergency. Senator Five, written all the way up to the President of the United States, President Obama, got no response. From my perspective, unless we declare a state of emergency and we need help, nothing's really going to happen. Now, we're talking because Vietnam War. Now, if you go back at the fall of Saigon, right after, and I was down there, not I was out of the military, but I was working for a company who was very interesting. We had all these Vietnamese refugees coming in, and they had set up Tent City down in Camp Pendleton. Many of them came back with what they call the gold tail. It's a little 1 ounce wafer of gold. And the company that I was working for, it was U.S. Silver Corporation. They were contracted by the government to go in and buy that gold, convert it into cash. And there were few people that made off very well. They were able to bring in gold. Many just came with the clothes on their back. And there were like 10,000 there. Now, you got to remember, we just came out of the war, and we went to the, being the nation that we are, very compassionate. Well, we set up this tent city, a refugee camp, and we helped these individuals that came to this country. They couldn't speak the language. They had nothing, really, and there were volunteers from the churches, the synagogues, from universities, colleges, businesses, families. Everybody was sponsoring somebody. And, you know, all of those refugees became very good American citizens. Many of them are in politics, are very successful. The interesting thing is, nearly 40 years later, half, 47% by VA's own admission, 47% of our homeless veterans are Vietnam War veterans. Now think about that. They're our age. These are frail, elderly veterans. Many have already died and all. John Rowland, who's the president of Vietnam Veterans of America, said there are more homeless veterans today than were killed in the war. So that means there's more than 60,000 homeless veterans from the Vietnam War. How can we as a nation ever allow that to happen? We could take care of 40 years ago of the refugees. Here we are in the 21st century, and we still have so many homeless veterans. And unless we declare a state of emergency like we did with the refugees, we're not going to solve this problem.
Now, what would the state of emergency, what would that entail? And what would that...
What I'd see is that, number one, that while we're the capital for homeless veterans, the Los Angeles VA, there's nearly 400 acres. It's the largest VA facility in the nation. Yet we have empty buildings. There's land. We'd have to set up similar to what we did there at Camp Pendleton. Number one, declare a state of emergency and say, this is just like they did 40 years ago.
I remember that.
Yeah, they put it together. You have volunteers. We're right next to UCLA. You have 30,000 students there. There's so many people that would be willing to volunteer. But just as Ted had mentioned, you get the federal government involved and you get the nonprofits involved, and they're all fighting over the same money. And at the end of the day, if a veteran, homeless veteran, gets $1.98 out of it, that's a good day for them. And that's got to stop. We need to put it all on a volunteer basis. Nobody's getting paid. Just be thankful that these men and women went out and put it on the line for us, and let's give something back. And we got to take the dollar equation out, because you can get a lot of this stuff donated, food, you get the shelter, the tents, Ted's Dome Village Project. There's so many things that can be done, but you have to, like you said, declare there's a state of emergency. We're going to do it at the Los Angeles VA, and this is what we need. Who's going to come in and fulfill that? And I think that until we get into that mode, we're going to still be talking about this years and years down the line.
Since we're on that, can you talk a little about, and then we expand on it, can you talk a little about the history of that land where the VA sits now? Can you talk?
Sure. I appreciate that. Back in 1887, actually, it was after the Civil War, they were building the National Soldiers Home throughout more in the Midwest and on the East. And they were at that time called the National Soldiers Asylum. And then in 1873, they changed it to home. And they were building these homes, and they decided to build the first one west of the Mississippi or in the Rockies, in somewhere in Southern California. Two families donated over 600 acres for it. And it stated six times in the deed that this land is to be permanently maintained as a national home for disabled soldiers. Before that was in 1888. In 1887, a year before, it took an act of Congress to establish that. So it's written, incorporated in the deed, that it's preceded by an act of Congress, and then we have a legal deed. And over the years, when they first built the home out there, that's in West L.A., right off the 405 freeway. And by the way, when that was built, there was no 405 freeway. There was no Wilshire or anything. Well, they came through and dissected everything, cut it in half. And that land has been confiscated in every manner you can imagine. If you know where the federal building is there, that's
on Wilshire.
Yeah, 28 acres. That belonged to the VA originally. Well, the VA didn't come into existence until 1930. Originally, it was a board of managers that ran the Los Angeles Soldiers Home.
Was it a national organization?
Well, it was interesting. It was, it was a government corporation, and it consisted, I think, of 9 members. No, I take it back. It was 12 members. Three of them included the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States, the secretary of war, at that time, it would be secretary of defense, and the Supreme Justice of the Supreme Court. So you have the three top people there, along with 9 members. So it's very close-knit. Again, nobody got paid other than those who were in there, but most of it was volunteers coming in to oversee it. They built, at that time, a Victorian-style architecture. They had beautiful resident halls with large verandas that overlooked beautiful landscape gardens. They had their dining halls. It was really like a city within the city, and they looked out for each other. It was run almost like a military post. They had what they call the governor, which was the head, they have over on the premises now. It was built in the early 1900s, what they call the governor's mansion, and the director today lives in there. But things have changed. In 1930, when they came in, they tore down all of those buildings, those beautiful, magnificent Victorian. And they, if you go over and you go through there now, they're a Mediterranean style, but they are more of an asylum looking. Very small windows. You look around, many of them got bars on it. And that's when they started experimenting also, because UCLA was next door to their medical center and all. On the lobotomies and all, veterans after World War One and all were experimenting with the law. And so that land suddenly became very valuable, because nothing was there at the beginning. And then when they brought in the water and all, things changed and it became very, very valuable. And they wanted to get the veterans out of there. And that's been a battle that's been going on.
And now sits there, baseball fields, theaters, rental trucks, and all that kind of stuff. Everything but veterans.
That's right. We every Sunday for the last 6.5 years, we stand outside the front gates here at Wilshire and San Vicente and protested every Sunday. And that led to the ACLU. It's interesting, Ted's been with us since day one on it. And when the first one, Ted hung the American flag on the front gate there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we always hung the American flag and the POW flag every Sunday out there. And for 66 Sundays we did. And one time we hung 30 flags across the front gates. It was beautiful. And behind the gates, though, Disney had a fundraiser, a celebrity fundraiser, $1,000 a person. And it was... we decided at that time that life and property are in danger. The property we knew was in danger. The lives of veterans who are homeless are in danger. And so we did what is in the U.S. flag code. We hung the flag in distress. And
Upside down.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I got arrested 6 times. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't mind it when the flag was up because we were sending out a new message, and it's not desecration and everything. And I had to go to court. I got them dismissed. I got the ACLU to defend me. We sued the VA for
won the case.
Yeah, freedom of speech. And that led to the second lawsuit as to why we hung it in distress, because the life and property were in danger. Mm-hmm. And we recently got a judgment. 9 pieces of property over there, parcels, are unauthorized by law, and therefore...
Rosenberg?
Rosenbaum, Mark, ACLU.
The lawyer for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the VA appealed it. They were trying to settle, and that fell apart. So now I guess it's going to go forward. But But it's kind of embarrassing. You got UCLA that's paying $5,000 an acre. I mean, for 10 acres, and apartments go for that over in Westwood.
Yeah, yeah.
And the market value isn't there. Everything about it is very bad, very shameful. Mm-hmm. It needs to be cleaned up, cleaned out, and mm-hmm. we need to start running it like a home. And you got Brentwood School, one of the wealthiest private schools.
Yeah.
It's all about what Ted was saying. You got all the money on one side. And the poor guys, you know, they've got it mixed up. The guys that belong inside are on the outside, and the rich and powerful are on the inside taking over. So we've got to do a flip-flop here.
Well, let me ask this, because, you know, it's a lot of economic distress in most of your hardcore cities, like Detroit, Cleveland, New York. Just go all over the country. But like you say, L.A. is the homeless capital out here for veterans also. Do you think we need a national approach to solving the homeless problem? And if so, how can we tie the local approach into the national approach?
That's a great question. And I totally agree. Yes, we do. And I think we have here in Los Angeles have to establish that and be a model. And that's like I said, first of all, declare there's a state of emergency, acknowledge it in the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And have that land and start working and create a model that we can move across the nation so every major city and even the smaller cities can follow that. Mm-hmm. It can be done. You know, look, we just came out of two wars, spent $2 trillion and bought, you know, everything you could imagine, and we don't have money to take care of the guys that fought it. Something's wrong with mm-hmm. you know, we as a nation, we the people, need to say, no, we're very grateful that these men and women defend our freedom, and we're going to give them the best that they deserve when they fought. You know, we give them the top, hire these major corporations that put out mm-hmm. hundreds of billions of dollars, and they come back. You know, we can't get a tent for them. Mm-hmm. So I think that we need to establish something here in Los Angeles, a model, mm-hmm. that can be rolled out across the country.
How do we deal with the bureaucracy that comes up? Yeah, I remember we talked about it earlier, how President Eisenhower warned everybody about the military-industrial complex, and then it shot up. We see it still in existence, causing a lot of wars. And then the prison-industrial complex, you know, money-making private prisoners and all like that. And now we see the same thing developing with the whole homeless, especially here in L.A. How do we deal with that? How do we get them to transition out of that, that really serve the homeless?
Yeah, well, I think what you have to do on that is just what Ted was talking about. Number one, I think we need to get back to an all-volunteer basis. Number one, mm-hmm. that there's no profit to be made off. Profit is in your heart that you've got freedom to go out and to engage in free enterprise, come back and give to those who gave so much. Mm-hmm. I think that you got to keep the government, the bureaucrats in check. There needs to be leadership of people who have no connections right now. And there's some people that we've got in mind that I think can do some great work and come in who've done things. But mm-hmm. whenever you start giving people salaries and expense account, they get, just as Ted said, they get consumed in that. Am I getting enough for my dollar here that I'm getting paid? Mm-hmm. We're the old Veterans Guard. I'm the youngster at 72. We got a 95-year-old. We've lost some 80-year-olds in
yeah.
it. But we're not even a nonprofit. We're ad hoc, and everything comes out of our pocket.
Yeah.
And therefore, we can't be bought. Nobody can come in and say, we'll give you this and that if you'll do this and that. And no, we mm-hmm. know what needs to be done, and I think we'd like to expand on that mm-hmm. concept.
Because one of the person that was supposed to be here, I hope she called in, that was Judy Bowman. Her father was one of the original Tuskegee Airmen in that. Let me ask one more question, then we'll go to a little community calendar. Want to do the reading and then come back discussion. Can you, what are your thoughts about the challenge of the female veterans? Since the, you know, military has kind of changed, What are the that they face that the male veterans don't face?
That's a great question. And just as an example, back 2 years ago, there was a black African-American lady, who veteran, tried to get inside the VA. She needed help. And because she wasn't an alcoholic or drug addict, they wouldn't accept her. And she was on the street outside. And I didn't have the wherewithal. I'd go over and, you know, take blankets and whatever. And she was sleeping on her nice lady and would engage.
A veteran?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they said if she came back in that they were going to arrest her. And I even talked with her. I said, well, maybe that's a solution. You know, it's shelter. She said, well, I don't want to do that. And she said, I'm not a drug addict. And I admired her so much. And finally, I had contacted every politician, Congress, Senate, City Hall, the city council, and the supervisors. The only one that responded was Mike Antonovich out of Glendale, supervisor, and he happened to be in China at the time. And he said, send a contact to his department there, and he said, send the county relief project out. And they went out and picked her up, took her over to the hospital, and got her admitted. That changed things. And I felt so bad. I mean, I see so many homeless male veterans. When you see a female, that is very, very moving and very difficult for me because they're so vulnerable. But it is, we need to provide the same kind of help for them that we do for all. And I think at the Los Angeles VA grounds, we need to set up facilities where there is and I also think that we should be, you know, once you get discharged, you were in what, the Marine Corps?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there was a real camaraderie there. But when you are discharged, you're a veteran at the VA. They don't care what branch you were in. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to bring that cohesiveness back together, because when you go to the veterans helping veterans, there's nothing better than that.
That's right.
And we need to separate this veteran issue. That they're Marines, they're Army, and bring that camaraderie and get that helping back together in the same way with the female. They're just not really good thinking. We're in the 21st century, supposed to be the smartest country in the world, and we can't solve this problem. There's a reason they don't want to, I think. Mm-hmm. And we got to overpower them and say, this is the way it's going to be done. Because you could take this project to a small group of grade school kids and they'll figure it out in 30 minutes.
Okay, we're gonna let's move to our community calendar. We come back to our reading and then get back and open it up for discussion.
This is our community calendar for upcoming events. Tuesday, November 11th, 2014 is Veterans Day, and at 1 p.m. the Full Scope Veterans will be celebrating. And on the program will be a 10-minute reading of Nobody Told Us. This play is being developed, written, and performed by participants of the Full Scope Veterans Workshop. Special musical guests will be Willis Boyd. Special guest speakers will be veteran Irene Cruz, veteran Teresa Varn, and veteran Lydia Naha. The MC for the program will be Greg Shane and Melvin Ishmael Johnson. Refreshments will be served and all are invited to attend. The location of the event is the Lake Street Community Center, 227 North Lake Street, Los Angeles, California. This is near the corner of Beverly and Alvarado. For contact information on this celebration of Veterans Day, you can call 213-479-1764. On Saturday, November the 15th, 2014, from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., the third annual Downtown Los Angeles Stand Down for Military Veterans will be on this day. And some of the services offered will be breakfast and lunch, medical exam, housing and shelter, clothing, counseling, entertainment, and much, much more. The location of the Stand Down will be the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. This is near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. And to pre-register or for more information, please contact the Vets Project 310-478-3711 or 626-730-1230. The Roby Theater Company presents The Magnificent Dunbar. This is a play written by Levy Lee Simon and directed by Ben Guillory. Opening night will be Saturday, November the 22nd, 2014, at the Los Angeles Theater Center, located at 514 South Spring Street, Los Angeles. This play is about the 30s and 40s on Central Avenue in Los Angeles, where the Duke, the Count, Dorothy Dandridge, and Lena Horne perform your favorite songs. This is the Magnificent Dunbar Hotel. For contact information, ticket, and other information, please call 213-489-7402. Levy Lee Simon, the playwright of The Magnificent Dunbar, and some of the actors will be our special guests on the Coonron Report, Monday, November the 17th, 2014. Also on November the 10th on the Coonron Report, we will continue short readings of Bloods. This is about African-American experience in the Vietnam War. And this is a production by Judith Bowman. New section on the Coonron Report will be Veterans Advocacy Connection, Monday, November the 10th, 2014 at 8 p.m. Veteran Irene Cruz and veteran Teresa Barn will be talking about veterans' resources and much more helpful information. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, please send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And the call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Earlene Anthony. And I want to move over to the actor, Matt Jennings, and he's going to do a reading from the excellent book, Bloods, that chronicle the history of the African-American in Vietnam, some of the testimonies. But I want to ask Matt, do you have any relatives that are veterans?
I do. My Uncle Rufus fought in the Korean War, I believe mm-hmm. it was. And I did a show a couple of years ago in college. It was called The Mighty Gents, where I actually played a Vietnam vet. Mm-hmm. And I was about 20, 21 years old. I had no knowledge. So I interviewed him to get some feedback and some understanding on exactly what the mindset is, what you went through, what he went through. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. I mean, and thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for
and
that.
And then you also okay. did a reading on June 19th at the Ford
yes,
Theater about the Tuskegee Airmen, the 101 Club.
Yes.
Dealing with that, which was an interesting piece.
Mm-hmm. That was a mm-hmm. great event.
Okay. So, Matt, let's take off with Matt reading from one of the Vietnam veterans whose name was...
His nickname was... Light bulb.
So, because he was so creative and coming up with so many innovative ideas. Okay, here's Matt Jennings.
I enlisted in the Army to stay out of the Marines. I had went to college for a semester at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. The expenses had gotten too much for my family, so I went and got me a job at McDonnell Aircraft as a sheet metal assembler. About 8 months later, two guys I went to high school with got drafted by the Marines, so I joined the Army so I could get a choice. It was August of 95. I was 20. My father was not too hot about it. He was in World War II in France and Germany. He was a truck driver on the Red Ball Express, getting gas to Peyton's tanks. He resented the Army because of how they treated black soldiers over there, segregated and not with the same support for white soldiers. My left ear was pierced when I was 9, just like my father's left ear was pierced when he was 9. Grandmother said all the male warriors in her mother's tribe in Africa had their ears pierced. Her mother was born in Africa. You can imagine the teasing I got in high school for wearing an earring, but I felt in this small way I carry on the African tradition. I would go in the Army wearing the mark of the African warriors I descend from. I did my basic and my AIT at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. Lost in the woods. Yeah. Trained for combat engineer to build bridges, mountain roads. But we didn't build too many bridges. Cleared a lot of LZs, did a lot of demolition work. I was sent on K, 8th Engineers Battalion, and attached to the 1st of the 9th of the Cav. It was in February after the first battle of Ia Drang Valley when 300 Cav troops got wiped out in the first real fight anybody had with the NVA. I was one of those replacements. We probed for mines, blew up mines, disarmed and blew up booby traps. One time I had to get a guy off a mine. It looked like it was impossible. This infantry unit was on a little trail west of Plu Koo, making a sweep towards Ia Drang Valley. This white dude had stepped on a mine and knew it. He felt the plunger go down. Everybody moved away from him about 20 meters, so they called for the engineers, and somebody asked for a light bulb. I have a nickname for the streets of East St. Louis, light bulb. Came from a friend of mine when we were growing up, because he said I was always full of ideas. When I got there on the chopper, he's been standing there for over an hour. He really wasn't in any panic. He was very calm. He knew if he alleviated any of the pressure, both of us would have got destroyed. I dug all around the mine with my bayonet and found out that it was a bouncing Betty. I told him I was going to try to defuse it, but the three-prong primer on the bouncing Betty had gotten in between the cleats on his jungle boots, so there wasn't any way I could deal with it. So I said, let's see if we could kind of change the pressure by taking his foot out of his boot and me keeping the pressure by holding his boot down. That way we could get out uninjured. But when he started doing that, I thought I was seeing the plunger rise, so I told him to stop. I guess maybe I'd been working with him for maybe an hour now. Then I got the idea. I knew when the plunger would depress, the bouncing Betty would bounce up about 3 feet and then explode. So I got the other members of his team together and I tied a rope around his waist. And everybody, including me, moved off about 20 yards from the mine and him. And when I counted to three, everyone would pull on the rope and snatch him about 15 feet off the mine. And it would bounce up its 3 feet and then explode. And it did that. And the only damage that he received was the heel of his jungle boot was blown off. No damage to him. This was something that they never taught us in school. This guy thanked me for saving his life and the life of his squad. And whenever we were back in base camp, I would always go with him. And since the platoon would always carry 3 or 4 combat engineers with them in the bush, I would always go with them. When I came to Vietnam, I thought we were helping another country to develop a nation. About 3 or 4 months later, I found out that wasn't the case. In high school and in the papers, I had been hearing about Indochina, but I couldn't find Indochina on the map. I didn't know anything about the country, about the people. Those kinds of things I had to learn on myself while I was there. We had a Vietnamese interpreter attached to us. I would always be asking him questions. He had told me this war in Vietnam had been going on for hundreds of years. Before the Americans, they had been fighting for hundreds of years against the Chinese aggressors. I thought we had gotten into the beginning of a war, but I found out that we were just in another phase of their civil wars. And they had a habit of exaggerating a body count. If we killed 7, by the time it would get back to base camp, it would have gotten to 28. And by the time it got down to Westmoreland's office in Saigon, it then went up to 54. And by the time it left Saigon going to Washington, it had went up to about 125. To prove we were really out there doing our jobs, doing really more than what we were doing. By then, I had killed my first VC. It was 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon somewhere in the Central Highlands. I was point man. I was blazing my own trail. I was maybe 40 meters in front of the rest of the squad, and I just walked up on him. He just stepped out of the bush. I didn't see him until he moved. I'd say maybe 50 meters. And then he saw me. We both had a look of surprise. I cracked him because it just ran through my mind it would be either him or me. I just fired from the hip, and he hadn't even brought his weapon down from his port arms. seems like a lot of green guys got killed just coming in country by making a mistake. I remember this white guy from Oklahoma. We got to call him Okie. He said that the reason he had volunteered to come over to Vietnam was because he wanted to kill gooks. He was a typical example of a John Wayne complex. It was a week after he had just gotten there that we had gotten into any action. He was just itching to get into some. We went out and got pinned down by machine guns. They were on our right flank. He saw where the machine gun net was, and he tried to do the John Wayne thing. He got up trying to circle around the machine gun net, charged the machine gun, and never made it. Whoever was firing saw him move and turned the machine gun on him. We stayed down until we could call in some gunships, then we moved back. There was another guy in our unit who had made it known that he was a card-carrying Ku Klux Klan member. And that pissed a lot of us off, because we had gotten real tight. We didn't have racial incidents like what was happening in the rear area, because we had to depend on each other. We were always in the bush. Well, we got out into a firefight, and Mr. Ku Klux Klan got his little ass trapped. We were going across the rice paddies, and Charlie just started shooting. He jumped in the rice paddy while everybody else kind of backtracked. So we laid down a base of fire to cover him, but he was just immobile. He froze. And a brother went out there and got him and dragged him back. Later on, he said that action had changed his perception of what black people were about. The women were much more friendly there. We had heard that was because they thought of the black man as being more stronger, more powerful, because Buddha was black. And take a good look at Buddha. You'll see that he has thick lips, has a very broad nose, and very kinky hair. But I didn't know that until I got into the country. Today I'm constantly thinking about the war. I walk down streets different. I look at places where individuals could hide. Maybe assault me or rob me or just harass me. I hear things that other people can't hear. My wife, she had a habit at one time of buying cheap watches and leaving them on top of the dresser. I could hear it ticking. So she would put it in a drawer, and I could still hear it ticking. And I dream of helicopters coming over my house, coming to pick me up, to take me to a firefight. And when we get to the firefight, they were dropping napalm on our own men, and have to shoot our own soldiers to put them out of their misery. After my discharge, I lived off my unemployment until it ran out, which was about 18 months. Then I decided to go back to school. I went 2 years, and then I got involved in Veterans Affairs. I was noticing that in my city, which is 95% black, that there were a lot of black combat veterans coming back not able to find any employment because of bad discharges or killing themselves or doping up. We started the Wasted Men Project at the university, and I've been counseling at Veterans Center ever since. In 1982, I transferred to the Vet Center in Tucson because I wanted to do some research on the Buffalo Soldiers. Nam, I didn't know they were part of the original 9th Cav. These are black boys who had just received their freedom from the United States, and they had to go up to the West and suppress the freedom from another race of people who were the Indians. I think they won 13 or 14 Congressional Medals of Honor, but they were really policing other people just like we were in Vietnam. When my son, Ronnie, turned 16, I had him sit down and watch all 13 hours of this film documentary about the war in Vietnam so he could have an understanding of what war was really about. He had asked, had I did any killing? I told him, yes, I had to. I had to do it to keep myself alive. I wouldn't want him to go and fight an unpopular war like I did. I wouldn't want him to go down to El Salvador. And if that means that I would have to pick me and my family baggage and move somewhere out of the country, then I would do that. America should have won the war, but they wouldn't free us to fight. With all the American GIs that were in Vietnam, they could have put us all shoulder to shoulder and had us march from Saigon all the way up to the DMZ, just to make a sweep. We had enough GIs, enough equipment to do that. When I came to Washington to see the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, I looked through the book, and there were about 15 guys from my hometown who were killed, and six of them I knew. But I looked up the memorial for James Plummer first. Plummer was a black guy from Cincinnati. We were the same age, 20. We were at Camp Alpha together. That's where they assign you when you first come to NAM. I was in C Company, a line company. He was a truck driver, so he was in headquarters company where they had all had the heavy equipment. I liked Plummer's style. He was just so easygoing. We would sit down and just rap. Rap about music, the girls, what was happening in the world. Get high. Plummer was a John Coltrane fan. And I'm being a Miles Davis fan would just automatically, we just automatically fell in with each other. He was my best friend. One day we were at the airfield at the LZ. Plummer was out of the truck over by the ammo dump, and the ammo dump received a mortar round. It blew him up. It freaked me out. I mean, that here I saw him, and 5 minutes later, he's instantaneously dead.
A couple extra minutes.
Me and two other guys ran and grabbed what we could. We pulled on the jungle fatigues, which was full of blood. It looked like maybe a dog after it crossed the street had got hit by a truck. His head was gone, both of his legs from about the knee down were both gone. One arm was gone, the other was a stump left. We finally got his truck together, and the rest of it we literally couldn't find because that one mortar round, it started the ammo dump to steady exploding. It constantly blew up for about an hour. What we found was probably sent back to the States, and they probably had a closed casket funeral. I kind of cried. I was saying to myself that this was such a waste because we weren't really doing anything at the time, and him just being such a nice fellow, why did he have to go this way, go in pieces? Everybody knew that me and him was tight, so a couple of guys took me up over to a bunker, and we rapped about him all night because we were out in the bush, and I really couldn't get no booze. But when I did get back, I bought me a half a gallon of gin and I knocked it off. And that didn't make me feel any better. When I got back, I called his mother. His mother knew me from him writing to her. I told her I was close by when he did get killed. I just told her an ammo dump blew up, and I'm pretty sure she didn't have no idea what that was. Every year I send her a Christmas card. I just signed my name. When I saw Plummer on the memorial, I kind of cried again. I guess deep down in my head, I can't really believe in God like I did because I can't really see why God would let something like this happen, especially like to my friend Plummer, why he would take such a good individual away from here. Before I went to Vietnam, I was very active in the church because my mother's influence. She sent me a Bible and I carried it in my pocket everywhere I went. When I couldn't find any Playboys or something like that, I would read it. Matter of fact, I read it from cover to cover, starting from Genesis. I guess I got kind of really unreligious because of my Vietnam experience. Now, I went to church once in my uniform to please my mother, but I haven't been back since except for a funeral. I've talked to chaplains, talked to preachers about Vietnam, and no one could give me a satisfactory explanation of what happened overseas. But each year I've been back, I've read the Bible from cover to cover. I keep looking for the explanation. I can't find it. Can't find it.
Okay, we got a couple little extra minutes. Let's take about 2 minutes for some closing comments from Ted and Bob.
Well, when it comes to a national plan, I suggest that everybody go to domevillage.us. Domevillage.us. And on the right-hand side, you'll see the National Plan in Homelessness, the Exodus Genesis Incentive Plan based on the Bible. Then on your right-hand side, you'll see the JSAP, the Joint Statement, the National Plan Law Enforcement Group. This group of law enforcement people are to adopt the JSAP plan and take that to the president to get the president to enact some measures that would get certain investors to invest in business ideas for the homeless.
Okay. Bob.
Yeah, Ted's project there is a direct way to go. Right now they have a building over there, Building 209, and the Congressman Waxman appropriated $20 million, and it'll have 65 rooms. It was a vacant, rat-infested building. $20 million for 65 veterans. We have 20,000 homeless veterans. For that amount of money, we could do the Dome Village many, many times over, and we could do it. They're still rehabbing the building 2 years later.
Oh.
You know, we built the Pentagon in 16 months, some 6 million square feet, and that was in about 75 years ago. We need to really start thinking like Americans again in doing what they were able to do. And we need to declare a, like you said, a state of emergency and a humanitarian relief project similar to the stand downs, but 24/7 till we get them all home. We need to go out on this just in like you were reading about what goes on in a war. No direction, nothing. It just helter-skelter, if you will. We need to start thinking and get it done. They did it down at Camp Pendleton with the Vietnamese refugees. We can do it with our Vietnam War veterans and make sure that this next generation does not go through what the Vietnam War veterans did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Bob and Ted. Excellent show. Excellent information. Yeah. And Matt, great reading. Great reading. Thank you. So thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. This is Melvin Ishmael Johnson. And we'll close out the show with Darker Than Blue by Willis and Shante.
Are we going around this town and let what they said come true? Jesus' name, I'm gonna get up. If you get off of me,